Our final speaker this morning will be Rabbi Dr. Steinberg. We will be discussing now sort of the continuing issue, which is now that this information has been obtained in whatever the methodology that have been discussed this morning, the questions that are going to be discussed now are going to be relating to transmitting that information. Again, the focus for this morning is going to be that there's different aspects. One is going to be from a physician point of view, there's physicians and medical confidentiality. And that applies to everybody that has a practice. I think the focus today that we'd like to get to, rather than that discussion, because, for example, if a physician in this room has a patient who has HIV and their spouse were to come in and discuss the issue of how's my husband or whatever the case may be, there's medical confidentiality. The discussion today is really, at least we'd like to focus this on in terms of the audience and the participation, the questions and the feedback would be, you are Joe Blow, the individual who was making a shidduch. And now the question is, what is information that has to be brought back and forth? Because there may be different questions with regards to the medical aspect. Now, needless to say, this is going to be overlap. And for this, I can't think of a better speaker and an individual to help us guide us through this difficult maze, Rabbi Dr. Steinberg.
Okay. Before even trying to answer some of the questions that were posed right now, I think we should discuss the fundamental halachic issues related to answering such questions. And actually, they relate to medical confidentiality, or from a halachic point of view, rechilus and loshon hora, tail bearing, and even spell. So, it is a little bit condensed on the slide, but I think to understand that will really help us to go further. I want to draw your attention to the fact that one of the greatest poskim in the previous generation, the Mishnah Brura, that everyone relies on today in paskening halachas, at least in the Ashkenazi groups, is not called the Mishnah Brura. It actually is called the Chofetz Chaim. Chofetz Chaim is the book that he wrote on one specific topic, and that is Rechilus and Loshon Hora. And that gave him the enormous name for posterity, because he was probably the first and the greatest one to collect all the halachas related to Rechilus and Loshon Hora, which we very frequently do not pay attention to, not for shidduchim purposes, but just talking around the table, and it is worthwhile to learn once and again and again this very important book that he is named after. So from a halachic point of view, the term confidentiality does not exist. You won't find in Shulchan Aruch a paragraph saying, these are the halakhos of confidentiality, of sodiyut refuit. That term, which is an ethical term, does not exist. The equivalent, from the halakhic point of view, of confidentiality is tale-bearing and gossip. That is what we are talking about. So any person, including a physician, who reveals information about another, transgresses a biblical precept. So remember, it is not just a good behavior. It is not just a standard of good practice. It is a biblical prohibition. And in fact, according to the Chofetz Chaim, one can transgress, one can violate 17 negative biblical prohibition, 14 positive precepts, and incur 3 curses by speaking Loshon Hora. Terrible. I mean, even doing thief or stealing something does not incur so many violations that someone who is just saying something which is considered rechilut and lashon hara. So I think that is a very important lesson for us to understand, that we are talking about something which is significantly prohibited. And as was already quoted in the Torah, the prohibition, lo telech rachil ba'amecha, you shouldn't be tailgating, comes right next to lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, which means that if someone is saying something about someone else in a forbidden way, can cause his death even. So it is considered a very serious prohibition. That is even so if no harm is meant, and even if the information is true, it doesn't matter. It is still violating the biblical law. And therefore, a physician who possesses information about a patient, whether provided by the patient or by others, is prohibited by the laws against tapering and evil gossip from disclosing that information. So that coincides with the ethical concept of confidentiality that we all as physicians and healthcare providers are supposed to obey from an ethical and a legal point of view, but from a halachic point of view, it is even stronger because, as we said, it entails so many prohibitions. But there are exceptions to these rules, and those exceptions are very important to understand and to apply. If the maintaining of confidence might cause harm to another, the latter may be informed, such as epilepsy and driving. In other words, the prohibition against rechilut is put aside when a third innocent party can be harmed by keeping this information secret. So that if I as a physician know that this patient has epilepsy and he does not want to disclose this information to the authorities and he continues to drive, it is my halachic obligation to call up the authorities and say this person has epilepsy because he is going to harm a third party who is innocent. At least in Israel, this is also the law. The law requires a neurologist to inform the authorities that his patient has epilepsy so that he cannot drive. A better way to do it, that is the halacha, but a better way to do it is to tell the patient himself to be honest about it and go and tell the authorities so that I don't have to do the uncomfortable task of talking against my patient. But if he doesn't want to do it, it is my halachic obligation to do it. Another exception is that if the individual's right to privacy conflicts with societal good, that others may be harmed, the harm should be prevented by disclosing the information, for instance, testifying in court. If someone is calling to a trial a patient of mine, and I know that this patient has a condition that indeed could cause that harm that he is required to do, then my testifying in court is not violating the chilus, despite the fact that he's my patient. That also is acceptable in civil law. A number of fundamental principles nullify the prohibition against tale-bearing, and that is when the other third party can be harmed. So the precept of thou shalt not stand idly by the blood of thy fellow man includes not only situations where a person is able to save another from death and refuses to do so, but also when he is able to save another from harm. So the idea of you shouldn't stand idle by your friend, by your friend's getting harmed, is not only when he is drowning and you have to jump into the water and pull him out, but also if your friend is going to be harmed by your non-disclosure of an information that can save him. That is the same concept, and that falls into this lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. Also, the obligation to return a lost object includes the obligation by a physician for the restoration of the patient's lost health and the removal of possible harm to that individual. And sometimes, in order to remove harm from person A, you need to disclose an information that relates to person B. And that is how you restore his health. The example would be the last one that Dr. Friedman mentioned right now, AIDS situation. If I know that the husband is an HIV carrier, it is my obligation to disclose it to his wife, even if he doesn't permit me to do so. Because by not doing so, she will be affected and she will die. So that is an obligation. And again, in the Israeli law at least, that is included in the law. I'm allowed, or maybe even obligated, I don't remember the exact language in the law, but from a halachic point of view, certainly I'm obligated to save the life of the wife by disclosing the information that her husband has HIV. I'm not talking about how to do it. There are ways how to do it. I'm talking about the principle. The obligation to save the pursued from the pursuer includes the case of a pursuer who has no intention of endangering the pursued because of enmity. Thus, everyone is obligated to prevent the pursuer from harming the pursued. So, by me knowing something that person A is causing damage to person B, we can look at person A as a pursuer who is going to pursue person B and cause him damage. And a roidev, we can damage the roidev in order to save the life of the one who is pursued. So there are a whole host of halachic, clearly stated situations where there is an exception to the prohibition. So the exceptions are valid only if the following conditions are met. And that, I think, is one of the most important, if I may give comments, the most important parts of the Chofetz Chaim, the book of the Chofetz Chaim. It is not just to show us how terrible it is to be someone who is saying Rechilus. It is not only to show us that there are exceptions to the rule, but it is how to use the exceptions and when to do so. And that is what the Chofetz Chaim does in a very lengthy fashion in his book. So the conditions to disclose information on a person because of fear of harm to another innocent party are the following. It is clear that withholding the information might lead to serious harm to someone else. It is not that I make all kinds of vague calculations that perhaps it can cause some damage and therefore I'm going and telling the situation. It has to be clear that avoiding this information will cause damage. So the examples I gave earlier, if I know that this patient has epilepsy, it is clear that he at some point as a driver might get an attack and cause damage. And therefore that is clear enough to be a situation to disclose this information. It should be as clear as that. The disclosure must be factual, accurate, and not exaggerated. So when we come to shidduchim issues, so if there is something that I'm allowed to tell to the other party in the shidduch engagement, it is not to say at the same time, this person has epilepsy and she's also a little bit ugly and doesn't walk straight and all kinds of other things that go with it. These exaggerations are not allowed. The fact that I'm allowed to disclose information has to be very pinpointed, not to use it to elaborate on other issues. The sole intent of the disclosure should be to prevent harm to the other person and not because of hatred to the person. It should never be, and that is something very personal, everyone has to test himself, I'm going to tell the spouse, the future spouse, about what I know about the shidduch that's going on, but I really hate this person and I don't want this to happen, and therefore I'm very happy to disclose this information. That is a wrong way to do it. The teller must ascertain prior to disclosure that the information will be used beneficially. Sometimes you can assume harm, you can be very clear about the harm, but you can assume very strongly that it will not affect anyway, one way or the other. So let's say that the couple is engaged, they love each other, it's sure, no matter what you tell them, that they are going to be a couple. Then to tell something that will not be beneficial anyway to the purpose that you disclose it will not be permissible because it just adds some suffering without benefiting. Obviously, it's a matter of consideration. You have to weigh there's no clear-cut points how to do it, but that should be in the back of the mind. If the putative harm can be prevented without disclosure of the privileged patient's information, the information must not be disclosed. If you can do the same good to the other without disclosing the information, then again the disclosure of information becomes a rechilus, that is not permissible, because you can get away without it and therefore not disclosing the information. Some examples that I encountered in my career was, for instance, I know that this couple, one side, looks for money. And if they know that the other party doesn't have money, they don't want the shidduch. But the other party, besides the fact that they don't have money, has also epilepsy. So there's no reason to tell the first party that this person has epilepsy and ruin his shidduchim with others. Because in this particular case, if it's a poor person and they are looking only for money, so you say they don't have money, that's less troublesome than to disclose that they have an illness. And therefore you can use these examples in such circumstances. The informer must have first-hand knowledge of the information. That is very important. Many people relay all kinds of information from hearsay. I heard from someone that someone told him that this one has that and that. That is pure rechilus. That is not an information that can be disclosed either for shidduchim or for other reasons. It has to be first-hand knowledge. You know best as a physician who treats the patient, he knows he has epilepsy, he knows he has Huntington's, he knows he has this particular disease, and therefore he is telling what he knows firsthand. It is not that I heard from health, and now I'm telling you what I have. Any potential harm to the patient by disclosure of privileged information must not be greater than the harm one is trying to prevent to another. And again, that is a matter of weighing the consequences of what you are going to tell, and there are numerous situations where the harm is so great that it doesn't pay to avoid a little harm and cause that much more harm. Therefore, only essential information needed to prevent harm to another individual may be disclosed, and only to the affected person. Where such disclosure is permitted, it matters not whether the person who may be harmed asks for the information or whether it is volunteered by the person who knows it. That is a very sensitive point. I am a physician, I happen to be a neurologist, I treat children with epilepsy and they grow up. Now I know this patient of mine has epilepsy and I hear that he is going out with someone. And no one contacted me, no one is asking me anything. Should I, on my own initiative, call up the other party and say, I know firsthand this information, which is an important information for you to consider. You may marry her anyway, but she has epilepsy. Or I am allowed, or maybe obligated, to disclose this information if I'm asked. The other party says, we heard that this person was a patient of yours. We want to know, why was she a patient of you and what was wrong with her? So I discussed it once. It's a very practical question. I mean, for me, it's a daily occurrence. I have learning disabled children, I have attention deficit disorder children, very violent, I have epileptic children. I have patients that grow up to become shidduch candidates, and I can sit every day on the phone and call everyone in the world and telling about all my patients what is wrong with them, which is important to the other side. Perhaps they know it anyway, but sometimes they don't. And I discussed it with Shlomo Zalman about it. And surprisingly to me, he took the Chofetz Chaim and literally understood the words in the Chofetz Chaim that if I'm asked, I have to tell. That is a must. If I'm not asked, I am permitted to tell, but I'm not obligated to tell. Now, to me it was a chiddush to take out a word in a Chofetz Chaim who is an Achron and to make out of it such a specific ruling. I mean, if you do it in a Pasuk, it's understood. If you do it in Chazal, it's understood. Even in Rishonim, it's understood. But to take the Chofetz Chaim and say, because he says mutar and not chayav, therefore he meant really it's mutar and not chayav, I couldn't do it, but that was the position of Shlom Zalman. So I'm telling you, at least according to Shlom Zalman Neuerbach, if you are, as a physician, asked about this patient and it is fulfilling all these criteria, you have to tell what you know about this patient. But if you are not asked, you are allowed to call up if you want and say this patient has this particular disability, but there is no must to do it. And I think that no one that I know, at least, sits on the phone, no physician that I know of, sits on the phone and calls up every shidduch that he heard that is going on and tells about what the patient has. Although, from a halachic point of view, it should have been. But I'm telling you what Rabbi Auerbach said. So now, let's go to some specific considerations about shidduchim. There is an obligation to disclose the information that is significant and fulfills all the above criteria, and I won't go over again and again the criteria, but I think it's important to realize that only when all these criteria are fulfilled, that is when we are talking about the disclosure. So first of all, the person himself, whether the male or the female who know that they have a disease and they go out on shidduchim, that is their obligation to take. When and how, we'll discuss a little bit later. It is also an obligation upon the parents of the male or the female who know that there is a disease to tell about the disease to the other side. And as we saw, there's an obligation on the physician to do so, because the physician usually knows it firsthand and it's clear to him and he can assess all the risks involved. It may be also an obligation upon anyone who knows, but provided that he knows it for sure and firsthand. It's not someone, as I said, who heard from someone, who told someone, and he is now disclosing the information. Now, when do these parties have the obligation to disclose the information? So again, I discussed it with Shlom Zalman Neuerbach and recently with Rav Eliashiv, and both are of the opinion that the person himself or herself doesn't have to go with a sign on her forehead, "I have epilepsy," and then whoever wants to contact me and knows that I have epilepsy, please call me up. They will never get any shidduchim at all. So the idea that they formulated was that you can go out once, twice, three times, just to get to know each other and not disclose anything. Once you feel that it's going to happen or it's getting warmer, then you have to disclose it before it becomes a reality. Because when it becomes a reality, it might be too late. People get in love and then it's very difficult to separate, and that is deceiving. So the compromise is, don't tell it from the start, but don't wait to the actual situation. I think that is a very practical approach for those who unfortunately have disabilities. Now, why should those agents disclose the information? A, because they should avoid kiddushei ta'ut, as was mentioned by Rabbi Glad, that if the person gets married knowing that he has a serious disease that the other person would not have married her or him knowing that he has that, then it is a kiddushei ta'ut and it can be nullified without a get, because for that purpose he did not or she did not enter in the kiddushin. So that is a serious issue, and there are numerous situations where such things happen. And if time doesn't permit, maybe later I'll tell you a story, a real story that happened with this idea. So there might be kiddushei ta'ut, and on the other hand, there is no prohibition of rechilut when innocent third party is damaged, as we said, and therefore it is lo tamod adam le'echa, it is voidev. There are all these reasons that you should disclose. So here are some specific examples that have been discussed specifically when and what and how to disclose. So if someone has an outward disability, he's missing an arm, or he's missing a leg, or he's missing an eye, he don't have to disclose it, because the other party will see it. Either he accepts or he doesn't. The whole problem is that outwardly the person looks perfect. He smiles, he's nice, or she, and they look okay. But they have something that from looking from the outside, you will never know about it. So the only way for the other party to know it is to tell it to him. And therefore, if there is a serious internal disease, which is not apparent, like cancer, or there's a serious mental disease, or infertility, which is serious, or epilepsy, or diabetes, these are examples of situations that you can't see outwardly that something is wrong, but it's serious enough that a person will not consider to enter into a shidduch if he knows it. Sometimes they know, and nevertheless they want it, that's fine. But they have to know it, otherwise it will be kiddushei tov. There are situations which are debatable whether you should take. For instance, someone who had a disease in the past, but currently he is healthy. He outgrew the disease. He was my patient for seizures, but he outgrew it, and now he doesn't have any more seizures. Should that be disclosed that he had epilepsy, but now he's healthy? Or someone who attempted suicide, and now he's clean and clear and fine, and there's no significant serious reason to think that he'll attempt suicide again, but it was a serious thing that he did. Is something like this also within the parameters of the obligation to take? Something that is temporary or is treatable, like a duodenal ulcer, that as long as it's there, it's uncomfortable to the person, but you can treat it and you can get cured. Should that be told? Someone who underwent plastic surgery, the nose looks very nice now, but once upon a time it wasn't so nice. So is that something that you should tell that it happened or not? Or someone who underwent orchidectomy for undescendant testes. He has one testes, he is procreative okay, but he is missing one testes. All diseases in the family that have no genetic background, which can add some burden or can cause some concern about issues of diseases in the family, but since it doesn't have a genetic background and the person himself is healthy, it makes less sense to disclose. And what is the probability of the danger that one has to disclose? Is it every danger? Is it 0.1% danger? Is it 10%? Is it 50%? So for instance, if a groom's brother has epilepsy, there is a 4% chance of the groom having it. Let's say the numbers are right. I'm not so sure that they are, but this is how it's presented to the poskim in some of the tshuvas. So they made a cutoff point of 5% risk. I'm not sure that we as physicians know how to calculate 5% risks in most diseases, but assuming we can, if it's less than 5%, you don't have to disclose. If it's more than 5%, you have to disclose. This is very arbitrary and it's debatable. So some of these issues are clearly issues that you don't have to disclose. I don't think that anyone seriously has to tell that he had plastic surgery. What does it matter? Now she looks fine, she looks nice, it's all done, and there's nothing repeatable about it, and there should be no problem. The same holds true for diseases in the family that have no genetic background. But these are borderline cases where some people might think that not knowing them would cause a problem to the other side. So, on the one hand, I think that currently there is an exaggerated effort in looking into defects of a person or a family. The shidduchim business became unbearable, I think, in most religious societies, and I think it's really exaggerated. No one is perfect, no one has a perfect family, and yet they look into the other and they want to see that the other one is perfect. Like Rabbi Glatz said last week, I had a shaila last week from a family that has two children with attention deficit disorder, and the boy that is in shidduchim doesn't have it. and he's offered a girl that has in her family three siblings with attention deficit disorder. He did not disclose that he had siblings of attention deficit, but he's asking what will be with the children because the bride has attention deficit siblings. So that is really going, I think, too far with looking into shidduchim. But on the other hand, it's always preferably to disclose than to live falsely. And as I said, there are many stories that can conceptualize these rules, but I think one has to go in a golden middle road to understand the halachic parameters of the isur echilus on the one hand, of the conditions where you're obligated to disclose on the other hand, and make reasonable calculations when, how, and to who to disclose this information. Thank you.
We're going to now have a, if I'm going to ask the panel to please come forward. I'll find out if this mic, maybe we'll bring the table a little closer because I don't think this mic is not handheld. Just being wary of the time and some of the logistics involved. At 11 o'clock, we're going to break for 20 minutes for a nutrition break. During that time, the rooms here are going to be converted back to the format of last evening. So I would ask you to please keep your questions brief. Stand here, ask them to repeat the. Do you have a mic? No. Okay. So perhaps the speaker will then come to the podium and then ask his questions answer the questions. Once again, please, in terms of time, we have lots of time, but at the same time, I'm going to ask the questions that this discussion this morning will close shortly before 11 to give some time to convert the room. Okay. Just Andre.
Rabbi Steinberg, you mentioned that if a parent approaches you and asks you about epilepsy in a woman or a young woman, you have a blocked obligation to disclose. But does that come from your civil legal obligation to the confidentiality? You're not looking at the civil suit having reached your civil confidentiality. The blocker and the civil law are not in tandem.
Well, first of all, a practical the question is that apparently, I'm not sure, certainly in Israel it's not so, as you say, I don't know the situation in the state, but let's assume that in the state, from a civil point of view, a physician is not allowed to disclose his patient's disease to someone else. If that is so, it contradicts with the halakhic obligation to do so. So one way is to ask the patient to allow you to disclose and get even a written allowance, which we do very frequently. And if he doesn't want to do it, then it points to the fact that this person wants to hide something which is significant, and certainly if it's a Jewish female or male, doesn't matter which side comes, it is your patient, you should explain to him that if this is being found out, then the kiddushin can be kiddushin ta'ut, and that would be analyzed. So it makes sense for the person to allow to disclose it if they want this shidduch. And in most instances, that's at least from my experience, it works very well. They give me a permission, a written permission, that I can disclose it to the other party, and the other party then asks me questions, and I answer the questions. And sometimes it's even better than the person himself explaining his disease, which he feels discomfort in doing so, and sometimes he doesn't know enough about it, and he's being asked about the heredity of this condition and the lifestyle of this person, and sometimes your information is even better than what the person himself can do. So I think that can be very well explained, and usually it works well. Now, if they tell you no, and you are obligated by the law of the land not to say, then you don't have to say. You are obligated by the law of the land.
Dina the Mufusa takes over.
Question, I think, for Rabbi Glad, had to do with screening. It's more common now for teenagers, the issue of adoption and teenagers. If we go with Rabbi Glad, who would like everybody to be tested, we now have a child we know, 16, 17, it's not possible. But there may be then a stigma of you saying, I don't need to be tested, everybody's tested. So do you then sort of keep this cover, say, well, I'll get tested, I'll deal with the issue of Garris later, or I don't need to be tested because I'm a Garris and I don't need to be tested. How do we go?
The question, just to repeat it for those who might not have heard, if I understand correctly, it's a very good question. And that is, if you test the parents, you're not necessarily testing the child because there are numerous other factors, i.e. adoption. Let's say the parents have gotten PGD and the child's genetic material is not actually from the parents or from both parents. Or any other scenario that you can come up with, heaven forbid, if the child is not really the child of those parents. As long as they're not filming, let's talk about that scenario where we say that Ro Bimos Hochel HaKarabal, that we have a halachic presumption that a child is the child of his mother and father, whereas we really only know definitively as a vadai that it's the mother who's the mother. The father is a halachic ro, that he's the father. So I think all of those are very good reasons why it makes a lot more sense to test the individual rather than rely on what I would call secondary information from the parent, which may or may not be accurate. I know a number of situations have come up where a mila was done on Shabbos, where there is halachic question as to whether that mila was really Delcha Shabbos. Hi, it's the eighth day, it was a vaginal delivery, but there are great poskim, including Rosh Hashanah Zatzal, Rosh Hashanah Shlita, and others who say that if there was any form of artificial insemination involved in the fertilization of that child, even in vitro fertilization, and it's the genetic material of both parents, it's not the shilas that we've discussed till now, that the mila is not Delcha Shabbos. Now, who's going to ask or know all of these pieces of information? And you're going to have, as technology gets more advanced, many more scenarios where the child's genetic information will be different than the parent's genetic information. And you're constantly testing for more and more things. If when I got married, I had kid sex testing. That was it. If you follow Dori Yisharim, you now have 9 additional, maybe 10 additional other tests. 10 years from now, there may be additional tests. So having a clean bill of health from parents from 20 years ago is certainly not going to necessarily be the most up-to-date information. I think, on the other hand, the Dori Yisharim has done such a wonderful job. It's a very easy system to use. It doesn't have any of the concerns that Rav Moshe discussed as a problem. It doesn't have the educational component to it. It doesn't have a format to change the stigma. What doctor would be needed to go and change that? There is a chiyuv, I think, to go make sure that we have healthy children. And Dr. Yisharim Marias Dati does a superb job in essentially eradicating these diseases from the Jewish community.
I'm not a medical professional, but I'm fascinated by the distinction we're making between what you're calling genetic diseases and other, quote, diseases that are rampant in culture, and the common reality that people are very open about things. I'm thinking about Crohn's disease. I'm thinking about anaphylaxis. If a child in a school isn't public about their anaphylaxis, it's clearly sakana nefashot, clearly. In public high schools where I work, there are walls of pictures, sometimes with EpiPens attached, so that everybody knows. And there's a law in Ontario that any EpiPen can be used for any kid, because the kids have to be open about this. And Crohn's disease, I'm not sure how genetically inheritable it is, but if one doesn't become public about it, or get the treatment of it, so to speak, how people eat, it's obvious. So why are we making the distinction between these obviously difficult diseases to the immediacy? Why would someone be embarrassed to keep the fact that they're a Tay-Sachs carrier? Why is there embarrassment about that when we're not embarrassed about these other things?
I'll let other people answer as well. You specifically asked a question I think was what I addressed. The reasons or irrational reasons that people do not want public information disseminated publicly is not here for discussion. that's not the question that's being addressed here. People do irrational things all the time. They have a right, halachically, to not want certain information to be publicly disseminated, even though you and I can say rationally that doesn't make any sense. Halacha has to deal with information being allowed to be made public or not allowed to be made public. One of the criteria is if it's going to harm somebody. If that person feels harm, you have harmed that person, then halachically you're not allowed to do something like that. Even sometimes this is for their own good. And there are certainly very good reasons to publicize something like a food allergy for which somebody or the caregivers or the teachers or the students are going to need to know how to address that. I think that's a totally different question. We need to educate people, yes, you want to publicize that information. Whereas something like Crohn's disease, I can't think of too many medical reasons why you would want to publicly announce that somebody has Crohn's disease, because medically there's not that many things that other people can do or should be doing or would do differently in their normal daily interactions. You know, I'm talking about the physician, I'm not talking about possibly their cook. I'm talking about their interactions with a friend or with a neighbor or a classmate. But if you could come up with a situation, so yeah, in any situation where you could come up, if there's a risk-benefit advantage to having that information disseminated, I think all of us would at least in theory say, sure, that's a positive thing to disseminate that information, but stigma and irrational fears aren't subject
to even though crunching could be a debilitating
thing. Can I interrupt here? There's a lot of people that want to ask questions, so if I could just ask the questions to be, you know, some brevity, and perhaps even if you direct the person we'd like to answer and the responses as well, so we can have, there's lots of people that want to get involved.
Kind of quickly to answer your question. There's a fundamental, I mentioned a question difference, which is genetic diseases are inheritable. So the answer is, whether I want my personal disease to be publicized is my personal decision. Like, if you meet someone and you want to marry them, they have one arm, you decide, do I care about how their wife goes on the arm? But the question about whether, if you knew it's genetic, and you know not only does this person have one arm, but all your children may have one arm, and all your grandchildren may have one arm, it's a very different question. This is a separate area because of the genetic nature. It's not the issue of the disease, it's the issue of the inheritability. That's why it's a completely separate question than just whether or not you should have an issue about diseases.
Warren?
I'll address my question, Rabbi Glatz. You said you didn't want to be the rub to Puskin on it, but the basic thing that I think many people up here have kids, they're going to be dating. At what point in the dating process should they discuss genetic testing with the partner? And part is, so they find out they're both KSATS carriers. Should they, and they really like each other, should they split up or should they have a life worth of PGD?
That I'm not afraid to discuss in Pasta. There are other things that go with me. Here I think it's very clear and simple. I would recommend that two people go out on the first date without knowing any genetic information necessarily. If they happen to know, great. But in the Darius-Sharon world, or people that are using Darius-Sharon, that should be one of the questions, not what the color of the tablecloth is what method of genetic screening would you like this couple to have? That's a good legitimate question. And the same, we use Darius-Sharon, both sides use Darius-Sharon. It's very simple. Go out the first date. There's a discussion to go out on the second date. So then on the second date, the conclusion of the second date, I said, if this is going to potentially go to a third date, check the numbers after the second date. Let me ask Doc, that's a very good time to go and check the numbers. If after the first date there's not going to be a second date, then don't waste your time. If there's after the second date not going to be a third date, then don't waste your time. But wait until that third date, the fourth date, the fifth date is done, you start getting emotionally attached to the people. I think the postman would say, things were down in the name of Rosh Hashanah, that he wrote down that you need at least seven dates. Now, I'm not getting into how many dates you need to have. In the Hasidic world, there's one 45-minute date, and that's usually after the tonight of inside of it. Chassid Shalom, I don't mean to make fun of that. That works wonderfully for that community. That's fantastic. At the same time, whatever is going to be a reasonable amount of time to get some sort of an emotional attachment, right before that period of time is when I recommend that they get their genetic compatibility affirmed, whether it's through direct or indirect testing, because that's when the tzaras are going to come. In this particular case, they've gone out four times. He said he thinks he's going to break up with them. What would I recommend? And I said, I think that's a smart thing to do, because a life, when you're going into it, you're knowing that PGD is the way you're going to get pregnant, is not a simple thing. And they were somewhat attached, but you know what? There's lots of people that break up after 4 days. And their lives will go on a lot more uncomplicated, again, in my humble opinion, than if they had continued and eventually gotten married. So I do think you want to test them early, but not so early that, as early as Steinberg said, a woman has epilepsy, she's never going to go out. And unfortunately, especially in the uneducated world, people say they're a take that carrier, they're a this carrier. We're not getting that in our family. Even if they, you can rationalize that we're not going to be in the children, but what about our grandchildren? And there's going to be carrier that's going to affect the shidduch of my great, great, great grandchild. People are irrational. And that's a reason to do the testing.
I may just add one point of information, which I think might be important. I agree totally with Dr. Glatt's opinion that if the couple is not up about getting married and they find out that they are carriers and they on their own decide to separate, that's probably the best solution. Because obviously to live in a PGD means to live with contraceptives, to do an IVF procedure, to do PGD, not always doesn't succeed, you have to do another cycle and another cycle. It's not as simple as it sounds. It's a good solution, but it's not as simple as it sounds. The fact that I want to relate to you is that it was said in the name of Abba Yashiv that he permits PGD, as I told you yesterday, I feel myself very privileged to be the one that brought to him the first time the whole process, and he passed the way he passed. But some related in his name that he allowed only one child to be born by PGD. And subsequently, don't have any more children if you are afraid of having serious diseases. Which didn't make much sense to me. I told that I understood it because according to Yashiv, you are not fulfilling the mitzvah of Piri Abelibia unless you're doing it in a natural way. And since IVF and PGD is not a natural way, you're not fulfilling the mitzvah of Piri Abelibia anyway. So the fact that you want a child is only a psychological need to have a children. And he supposedly decided that it's good enough to have one child. That's good for all the psychology of all couples in the world. It didn't make much sense to me, and I was lucky to come to him with a couple that asked me to present to him their questions about PGD. And he said, I obviously already gave a heter, well, why do you come again? And I said, the reason we came with this couple is because they have three other children. So he said, mother, so what? Which I think means very clearly that what was said in his name was wrong. Even if they had a few children, they can have more children when they choose to have PGD. So that at least clears the field. If someone really wants to get married knowing that they are carriers of the disease and living the way to have PGD children, they can have as many children as they want.
I think it's quite a good one. I think it's wonderful that we've reduced the instances of the disease by doing genetic screening ahead of time. But what about the fact that by doing the genetic screening, you're basically increasing the number of carriers in the population?
I think I'm not sure if it's the third slide that I showed. You have to understand recessive diseases. You cannot eradicate a recessive gene. This is not going to, I'm not sure if, I have to think of the exact numbers, but I'm not sure that statement is true. That is, even if you have two carriers marrying, half of their offspring will be carriers. And if you have one quarter will have the disease, half will be carriers, and a quarter will be unaffected.
If you have four people, two that are carriers and two that are not.
Correct.
And by doing the genetic screening, you're forcing the carrier and the non-carrier to marry, and the carrier and the non-carrier to marry.
Correct.
In the next generation,
right.
Well, what you would have had is you would have had, I mean, that's not about my child would have had 10 seconds,
right.
But what you've basically effectively done by the 65% for Islamic, is you would increase the number of carriers.
Actually, what you're doing is, as an actuary, if you allow, if you do the screening, you maintain the ratio. If you don't do the screening, you slowly, just microscopically, diminish the ratio because the Tay-Sachs baby does not reproduce. So by screening, you're maintaining the one in four.
Right.
By not screening, you might get to one in 4.01.
Right. The magic word to me is the word de minimis. The answer is, I can't even imagine, right, putting on a scale on one side, haystack babies dying, and a statistical probability of a 1,000 decrease in the number of carriers. I want to point out two things, some which just so people realize, just about screening. One is, we talk about Jewish genetic diseases, and this is a little bit of response to Israeli class. Understand that the Dorsham system, what works among people who are, I would say, somewhat affiliated, if your goal is medical, if you want to increase the disease, right, it would seem to me the vast majority of Jews are not going to go anywhere near Dorsham. That is, we talk about Jewish genetic diseases, not for religious reasons, it's an ethnic thing. It simply matters, to some extent, where your grandparents came from. So if you want to decrease the incidence of Tay-Sachs, fibrosis, and things like that in the population, you've got to get all the people who are carrying the gene. And people come from Jewish genetic diseases because they travel together. If you could show that left-handed people had a much higher predisposition for, bad eyesight, but I said maybe called a left-handed disease. It has nothing to do with religious observance. Therefore, I agree with everything that Rabbi Glad said. Just understand that the population, as a general rule in America, right, it is a very small percentage of people ever going to get involved with their insurance. I do agree that for people who understand what it is, and sort of affiliated that it works and it's fantastic, but this does not in any way minimize the need to go out there and really push for general genetic testing. The other thing, by the way, is called GINA. Last year, it's called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. It's on the last page of the handout I gave you. It's a federal law now. It's not state by state. Federal law that makes it illegal to discriminate on the basis of certain genetic findings. You can read about it in the last page of the handout.
If I just may say something about your point. The Torah Shorim is very important for religious people because the non-religious community performs abortion. They don't have this problem that those who do not agree to abortion have. So if you don't screen them, they will have a sick child. If you don't screen the non-religious people, they nevertheless won't have a sick child. So that's why I think it's a very important concept. Problem is that Torah Shorim is very good for shidduchim. It's less good for those who meet and date, and when they get far advanced, sometimes it's too late to make this decision, although it's early enough to do the PGD. So I think a variation of Torah Shorim has to be invented for the in-between group, those who would not do abortion, but those who are not dating by shidduchim, but rather by meeting accidentally, and they will need somewhat modification of the Torah.
Okay, this will be the final question, and again, the answer will be brief. After this, we will break for nutrition break. Last question.
This is a question for Rabbi Dr. Lack about AST testing. I agree with you completely that back in the 90s, when they discovered these genes, there wasn't a whole lot to offer people who got tested, because we didn't know if we could modify the outcome in any way. But today we now know that the problem is expected to be lower in death rate, the flax is expected to be forever be lower in death rate, and MRI screening lower in death rate. So our student had a 37-year-old woman, very strong, who had breast cancer, and I wanted to test her for the gene. First of all, she was at risk for cancer in the other breast, she was at risk for ovarian cancer, and she said, no, I don't care what happens to me, I have four daughters, and the woman I should have prayed, someone here is going to be able to go for one of these procedures, they know right away and not right. Okay, she didn't make that choice, let's say, but what about the sister who, won't get tested because she doesn't know that her sister is here? What about the cousin who wouldn't qualify for any screening or prevention in Ontario because we can't test that person without having a family relative? We're only obligated to encourage that person to get tested.
I don't think we disagree at all. I specifically mentioned that there are tremendous potential advantages to knowing the person's BRCA status, but it has to be an individual decision. If this, I don't think from a halachic point of view, you can mandate somebody to go get BRCA testing. As a physician, for the physician to recommend it and advocate it, for wrong to recommend it and advocate it, it's certainly something that is, I think, a very reasonable thing to do. For the sister, for the cousins, they're wrong, their personal physician should be recommending based upon their risk factors, what they are.
Yeah.
if you have a first degree relative that have breast cancer, that puts you at an increased risk for breast cancer. That's a different question. You're asking now an insurance question. You're asking the medical question, and that is a halachic question. From a halachic point of view, I agree with you. It's recommended that they should be offered BRCA testing, understanding what it means to them. No doubt about it. From a halachic point of view, to say that they're mechuyev to take BRCA testing, I don't think you can make that argument that they're mechuyev to take testing. Very valid argument to make in favor of doing it. It is not a halachic argument to say that you're mechuyev to do it. There's a distinction between the two. Halacha doesn't mandate that every single person get every single screening test on every side.
The first question is the individual mechuyev to inform the cousin that
so
they are...
That's the same question that you ask with any disease that's potentially genetically transmitted. Are you mechuyev to call up every single one of your relatives and say, I just was diagnosed with this disease. There's a 2% chance, an 80% chance that this is something that's in the whole family. Are you mechuyev to do that? That's a different question. This question if that's your question, so the answer is halacha doesn't demand that you tell every single person that you have a genetic predisposition to a disease that they may theoretically have. Should that person have that information? In an ideal world, yes. 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 We agree. We're 100% agreement. Should that person be advised, recommended by a rogue and or the doctor, you should tell your other relatives that you have a genetic disease that is affecting potentially them and their progeny. My answer to that as a physician would be absolutely yes. Where as a rogue, I would say yes, you should do that. If the rogue was asked, am I mechuyev to, I don't think the answer is that you're mechuyev to. Why is it not because of the Bashas? Because it's not a case of Vatek Pikuach Nefashos. It's not even an ordinary case, I think, of Sofek Pikuach Nefashos. It falls into a category of something that is allowable, permissible, maybe even something that's good. If you could donate your kidney to them, you could really save their life. Are you mechuyev to do so? No, because you're potentially damaging yourself. And this person chooses, for whatever the reason, not to disclose that information. I don't think that there's a halachic chiyuv. Maybe Rabbi Steinberg would like to disagree. I don't know. I don't think that there's a halachic chiyuv to go and disclose that information.
I'd like to close the, with all due respect, please. I'll tell you like this. This is how it works. No, no, no. And then feedback, you went over time. You didn't give time to the next speakers.
We're in the middle of something.
I appreciate that. Go ahead.
Those who want leave, those who want stay.
I need we have to convert the room. We're having the
next vote on it.
There is. Okay. Please, go ahead.
Be brief. I think that there is a difference between the obligation to donate a kidney to save someone's life and to disclose an information which may be a little bit uncomfortable to the person. But why shouldn't they tell everyone in the family? I guess because they feel uncomfortable doing so. It's not that any harm will come to them by disclosing. Obviously, there will be harm to them if they'll give a kidney. So I think there is a difference between the two, although both are recommended. That I think there's no disagreement. The question is there a few of me that knows that by my information I can save someone's life or improve someone's quality of life, should I tell it to him? I don't see why it should fall into the broad category of lo tamot adam le'echo. Any harm that can be avoided to someone else, I'm obligated to do it. Can someone take me to a court of law and say, if you didn't do so, we'll punish you? I assume not. But that there is an obligation, my feeling is that there is an obligation, especially if it's something treatable. Time doesn't permit, but even in Huntington's disease, I think there is some obligation to tell the other family members that I was tested positive, they should go and test themselves, because if I tested positive, everyone is in a suffix having Huntington, but not everyone has Huntington. So if they don't test,
they are within the suffix of having Huntington. If they test, some will be found out to have Huntington, but they knew it anyway because they are part of this family. Whereas those who will test negative, you save their lives. They can live now a normal life, get married and have children and do so many good things. So I think that there is an obligation. I don't know if it falls directly within Lo Tamodot Darlech or Vashemot HaLo. There is something in my feeling. I mean, it's a feeling difference between the two of us, that knowing something that can save someone else is an obligation to tell unless it harms me. And I don't see what the harm is by telling. It's a discomfort of my life.
Just please look at page 10 of the handout I gave you. I have a full page on this exact question. So it's page 10 of the handout, informing relatives about the economic disease.